This webcast is a service of SDPB. Good, useful, and full of wonder. SDPB.
You may be seated. Thank you. The next case set for argument this morning is State of South Dakota versus Celestine. It's appeal number 31116. Matthew Marabella will be arguing on behalf of the defendant, Mr. Celestine, and Renee Stelliger is arguing on behalf of the State of South Dakota. We have sitting with us this morning Second Circuit Judge John Sohn, who's sitting in place of Justice Robert Gazinski. We appreciate his willingness to sit with the court today.
Thank you.
With that, Mr. Marabella, you may proceed with your argument.
May it please the court and counsel, good morning again. And I thank this court for the time to speak on behalf of Mr. Celestine, who asked this court to reverse and remand to allow him to withdraw his Alford plea and proceed to a second jury trial on the merits of the case. Pre-sentencing withdrawal motions are to be liberally granted, and the totality of the considerations here for Mr. Celestine weighed heavily in favor of withdrawal, with the two most important factors establishing the fair and just reason threshold requirement being innocence of the crime, as well as mental health considerations, which ties into the factor of the context of knowing involuntariness of the plea. I would like to spend most of my time on those two considerations, as I believe those are the most important, and then I will touch on the other relevant factors in the analysis.
So one of the problems with the innocence claim, as I see it in the record, is that when the trial court inquired and said, you know, tell me about your innocence claim, there was really no articulation of what that looks like. I know there is on appeal in your brief. You talk about the fact specific intent. That was never raised, was it, in front of the circuit court?
The evidence where it does not a bare assertion for innocence, which would not be sufficient, and that part is made clear, comes from Mr. Celestine's words that were the evidence used at trial against him is what establishes his innocence from his own statements, which the record well reflects, particularly the trial itself. So Mr. Celestine, essentially, the evidence from the witnesses at trial, he's telling everyone what the defense is and why he is innocent of the specific intent statute.
But when he makes his motion to withdraw his plea and the judge says, tell me about your innocence, he just says, I'm innocent.
Yes. The rest of the record, which primarily including his statements, is where I submit that he is submitting.
But that shouldn't be surprising. It's an Alford plea, right? No one should be really all that surprised that he doesn't have a lot to say about actual innocence, because he never truly pled guilty in a traditional sense. He entered a guilty plea, but unlike so many other defendants, he did not affirmatively acknowledge factually his guilt. And one of the things that I wonder about when we look at that factor is whether we're really assessing the contrast between a defendant at a change of plea hearing who says, I'm guilty, here's why, here are the facts, I am really, really guilty. And then later seeks to withdraw the plea and says, I am really, really innocent. And this factor, to me, is designed to let the court assess the contrast between those two. But it falls apart a little bit for Alford pleas, because the defendant maintains his innocence throughout. Is that factor even all that important in a case like this?
Yes, and I first, to be clear, as many cases, including State versus Engelman, which I'll talk about with another factor later, makes clear there's not an automatic right to withdraw just because you're doing an Alford plea, and I'm not suggesting that that's the case. That being said, with that caveat, I am suggesting that we should, in terms, again, of the ultimate framework of liberally granting these motions, pre-sentencing, post-sentencing is a different situation, we start from a liberal granting perspective of the totality of the lens, but if he pleads via an Alford plea, and what that is obviously maintaining his innocence or unable to admit facts that make him guilty, then I think that that should be relevant to the overall assessment. Again, not an automatic right to withdraw just because you've done that type of plea, but the fact that he did not come in and state his factual guilt, and then looking at the statements that he made from the trial that we had, I think is relevant in terms of the innocence factor, showing that we have a plausible assertion here. And again, the requirement.
But Engelman seems to suggest that inquiry of innocence really doesn't have much, and to Justice Salter's point, doesn't have much fortitude when you've already entered an Alford plea and said, I'm innocent, but there may be enough evidence to convict me in this case. And it seems like Engelman kind of said, you know what, you can't really come in and claim innocence on a motion to withdraw a plea when you've entered an Alford plea and already maintained your innocence by nature of your plea.
And I think the main principle from Engelman with respect to that is that it's not an automatic right. And what the totality of the case law addresses with...
So in other words, you need to have pretty good evidence or some basis to come in and say, because it's now your burden of proof as a defendant to come in and say there's a good and just reason to allow me to withdraw my plea. It's your burden to prove that. And there isn't really anything here that he presented to the trial court.
Lucian specifically at the change of plea hearing made no statements about the case whatsoever. So at that hearing, there's not the evidence in the record asserting the innocence component. The primary piece that comes from is the trial that we had in 2023, where from his own words, we're hearing the innocence of him that we submitted and argued at trial, that he is lacking this specific intent. So I think that is where it's not a bare assertion.
But he didn't even say to the court, hey, look at what I said at the trial.
Right. And I think I'm going to speak to mental health as well, and I think that is part of the issue here in terms of his understanding of what's going on in the proceedings. And he was found competent. That part was made extremely clear. But in terms of the mental health aspect of this case that I think is difficult to ignore in terms of both innocence but then also the knowing involuntariness issue, it's difficult. For example, when he is asked for his plea, he says, I accept the benefits of these charges. It doesn't make sense. It calls into question his understanding of what he's doing and making that reasoned choice to plead and going through that.
Let me ask you, do you see a difference between a claim of actual innocence and having what you think might be a good defense to the crime? Because I'm not so sure. I think there might be a difference there. If you look at actual innocence as factual innocence, I did not do this. I am factually innocent. That seems different from the argument that, well, I did all the conduct, but I actually have a defense. I'm not sure that having a defense is the same thing as actual innocence. What do you think?
I agree that those may not be completely connected as the same. For Mr. Celestine, what he has is assertions from his own himself that he can't possibly meet the specific intent requirement of the statute and an essential element of the case. And his own words are what gives us those facts, showing that and I think that one of the issues with the innocence factor to address is we're talking about a plausible defense to the charge. We're not, the circuit court's analysis is not to decide, it's not a court trial, it's not to decide if it's a winning argument, as one of the cases I put in my brief discusses. It's to see if this is legitimate to take to a jury. And we know it was because we already did that about a year and a half before the plea. Mr. Celestine had already submitted from his own words, the jury heard everything that he said, and I think that there, throughout this case, the evidence has shown that he is essentially entirely missing this element of the crime. For example, to point to some of the components
Counsel,
of the record.
So I just want to stop you there a minute. This is kind of where we started out here. It appears to me that what you're doing here is really challenging the court's acceptance of his Alford plea to begin with. But this isn't the issue on appeal, is whether the court erred in denying his motion to withdraw the plea. right?
Yes.
So this isn't just a straight up, this isn't a challenge to the court. You accepted a factual basis based on the record that doesn't meet all the elements. That's not where we're at right now. Right now, the argument on appeal is, did the court err in denying the motion to withdraw the plea? So all the stuff you're talking about right here, none of that was provided to the court in the written motion to withdraw the plea. And as noted at the beginning of the argument, the court says, okay, what else do you want to, make a further record? What do you have to say? And it was, no, we'll just rest on what we submitted. So how do we now fault the court for not making a determination about what you're arguing here is a lack of one of the elements that needed to be proven when you didn't present that to the court as a reason for why he should be allowed to withdraw the plea because he's now claiming innocence?
So we're not challenging the factual basis, although I would note from review of the change of plea hearing transcript, there isn't, and again, because it's been missing in the evidence of the case as the trial demonstrates, there isn't a clear assertion of what the specific intent that qualifies is in the record. The factual basis was laid by defense counsel. Mr. Celestine, because he's doing an Alford plea, didn't make any other statements. So in terms of what the evidence was at the change of plea hearing, the political evidence, the political nature of the evidence isn't there either. But the primary piece of the innocence component is that his statements were made to a jury. They evaluated this specific issue. And
I understand all those arguments you're making, but I come back to my question. None of that was presented to the circuit court at the hearing to withdraw the plea.
Yes, and right. What the circuit court was not presented with at the change of plea hearing was political evidence to support the specific intent requirement.
Engelman rejected the actual innocence claim. What swung it in Engelman was the defendant's mental health, voluntariness of the plea. Talk about that. I know that's your other basis for claiming the court erred in the denying the motion to withdraw the plea.
Thank you. Yes. The other component in terms of context of knowing involuntariness, specifically mental health concerns. Mental health concerns relate to the innocence factor because of the voices in his head and how that's really what the lack of specific intent is about. But it also is the crux of some issues here that I think is a separate independent reason for fair and just reason to establish the withdrawal. So this record is from 2019 because the way this case starts, it was State's Exhibit 1 at the trial, was a phone call from September 1st of 2019 that Mr. Celestine made to the FBI talking about voices in his head and what they were telling him to do. The CIA was reading his mind, things of that nature. And then all the way persisting through 2024 where the case begins to conclude, where the change of plea happens in November, and then in December we have the withdrawal hearing. And the record is replete with concerns, similar concerns, I think more grave concerns than what State versus Engelman presented. And I would just note a few pieces of the record and then tie it back to that authority. In 2023, during the pretrial litigation, you know, we have a record that Mr. Celestine is diagnosed with schizophrenia. The state had attempted to motion limine to keep that out. There had been motions made at many times, including August 1st of 23, where Mr. Celestine desired to represent himself, and the court's record there with respect to that, I think, ties into the mental health component, where the court explains, I don't believe that he understands what he's doing, and I strongly believe he's not intelligently waiving his right to be represented. Now, that's in the context of the right to be represented, and then that comes in again at the withdrawal hearing, where it's discussed by the circuit court that his mental health concerns are too severe. Is diagnosed, not that there was lacking evidentiary support, which was the case of State versus Schmidt from this court, where there was really lacking evidence that we had these mental concerns. Here, it's all over the record for many years, and as the court discussed at the withdrawal hearing and assessing, talking about his desire to represent himself, but it's in the context of the mental health component, the court discusses that there's no dispute in this case that Mr. Celestine suffers from a diagnosed mental illness, and that's all part of the record. The court listened to evidence of his mental illness at trial. All of the parties agreed that this was a reality in this case, and then The court specifically discusses a letter that he wrote right after we had the first jury trial where he was opposing the state dismissing his case. And as it was described by the circuit court, that this is the very height of someone who does not understand what is going on. So from the date that the first phone call is made to the FBI, where there are clearly these mental health concerns with the voices in his head and what's going on, and then through all of the litigation of the case, before the first trial, during the first trial with the evidence presented, and then after that, including a year and a half after that, where these things are still going on.
So the court never should have let him plead guilty. Is that your argument?
My argument is that this is a consideration for, again, the framework of...
And I agree with Justice Devaney. I don't think that's the order we've got in front of us, but is that really where this leads to you?
No, not that, and it's his choice to plead. And he was found competent in these proceedings, and it's ultimately his call. It's not up to his attorneys whether he wants to accept what he was offered, which was an attempted terroristic threat plea for a recommendation of credit for time served. But what we have then is factoring in the mental health component for his quickly deciding to request a withdrawal. So not that he shouldn't have been allowed to plead, but factoring in if he understands the choice he's making. I see that my time, if I may briefly conclude.
Go ahead.
Thank you. Primarily for the reasons of mental health concerns, as well as most importantly, I believe, the innocence assertion, Mr. Celestine asked this court to reverse and remand to allow him to withdraw his Alford plea. Thank you.
Thank you. Ms. Dellinger, you may proceed. With your...
May it please the court and counsel. The sole issue on appeal is whether the circuit court abused its discretion in denying Celestine's request to withdraw his Alford plea. On the first day of Celestine's retrial, he indicated he wanted to waive his right to trial and plead guilty pursuant to Alford instead. The circuit court accepted his plea, finding that a sufficient factual basis existed. 20 days later, Celestine moved to withdraw his plea, arguing he was factually innocent and that he was previously denied his right to self-representation. South Dakota codified law allows a defendant to withdraw their guilty plea prior to being sentenced, but this court has held that a defendant must show a fair and just reason for doing so. In this case, the circuit court denied Celestine's request to withdraw his Alford plea, finding that a fair and just reason was missing. First, the circuit court held that it had previously properly denied Celestine's request to represent himself. The circuit court noted that a defendant has the absolute right to represent himself based upon a knowing and intelligent waiver of that right. However, Celestine's mental health, coupled with the bizarre understanding of his rights, especially his desire to oppose the dismissal of the action against him, rendered him not competent to conduct his trial. Further, the circuit court found that Celestine's claim of actual innocence was just a conclusory claim asserting that he was innocent. As this court has stated, self-serving testimony, much less simply a conclusory assertion proclaiming innocence, is not a persuasive basis to allow a defendant to withdraw a guilty plea.
Is there a difference between actual innocence and a defense? In other words, someone pleads guilty, they think about it, a couple days later they say, I've got a really good defense, should have asserted that. That seems like a really good defense, as opposed to somebody who said, I never did any of it. Is there a difference, or is it too fine of a distinction?
I agree with you that there is a difference between those two.
How does that factor into, you know, and I don't want to get too formulaic with these factors, because in the end, it is a good and a just reason. The factors are helpful, but how would that play into our consideration?
Yes, in this case, in the Schmidt case that this court had previously ruled on, it held that actual innocence is the factor that should be considered. While this court has not defined what actual innocence means in this context of a change of a withdrawal of plea, it has held in other contexts that actual innocence means factual innocence, not mere legal insufficiency. In this case, he's alleging that he lacked the specific intent necessary for the crime, which would be a claim of legal innocence, not actual innocence.
And people give up those arguments all the time when they plead guilty, Alford or otherwise. I've got a defense. I'm not willing to risk it. And so I'm going to take the benefit of this plea agreement.
Correct, Your Honor.
So a couple other factors that the court has traditionally looked at is the delay between the plea and the request. Of course, it came very quickly here after the plea was entered. Prejudice to the prosecution. Court found both of those really favored the defendant in this case. Are those factors alone enough for a fair and just reason to withdraw a plea if there's no prejudice to the state? We've said these should be liberally granted. Where there's no showing of prejudice, or the court doesn't find any significant prejudice or delay in between the plea and the motion, is that enough?
No, Your Honor. Celestine's quick timing of the 20 days between his change of plea and his formal request to withdraw does not equate into a fair and just reason to withdraw his plea, and this court has never found that timing alone is a fair and just reason. Regarding the prejudice to the state, the circuit court did find that the passage of time risk witness availability, so the circuit court did find that some prejudice to the state would be had if it allowed.
It doesn't seem like actual prejudice. It seems like maybe the potential or the possibility that there might be prejudice. I'm not sure that's prejudice. That just seems like there could be prejudice, maybe.
Correct. That it is.
But that's kind of like not having prejudice, but.
Sure.
Maybe there could be at some
sure.
point.
And lack of prejudice alone is not enough to mandate withdrawal. There must be a fair and just reason. And this court has held that in the Kalpatra case specifically.
But it's a totality of the circumstances assessment. It's not a, as Justice Salter would call it, a divide and conquer argument. I mean, just because each one is maybe not good enough, they could have all gotten together and been enough, right?
Correct. Yep. Fair and just reason under the totality of the circumstances.
The state never argued that we've lost a witness or something like that,
no,
right?
Or any specific witnesses that have moved away or specific evidence. The state did not point to that. The state just alluded to prejudice as a whole.
Could the circuit court, taking this, the totality of all the circumstances, say, look, this case has been going on for a long time, lots of years. I think that when Mr. Celestine came in front of me, I observed him. I thought it was a good plea. I thought it was knowing. I thought it was voluntary. I thought it was the disposition of this case. And in the exercise of my discretion, I am not going to permit the withdrawal because I think it was a knowing and voluntary, provident plea supported sufficiently by facts. And so we're going with that. Could the court do that?
Correct, Your Honor, and that is what happened in this case, that the circuit court found that Celestine intelligently waived his right.
Without regard to prejudice, without regard to any other, just sort of said, no, this is knowing, this is voluntary. I think he knew what he was doing.
Correct. It is the defense's burden to show a fair and just reason.
So in Engelman, the court found that circuit court had abused his discretion mm-hmm. in denying the motion in a situation where the defendant was suffering from, I think, some depression and some mental health issues at the time of his plea. Court said that's enough. That's enough of a good reason that we're going to overturn the court's decision. How is this? You've got some significant mental health concerns here on the part of Mr. Celestine in terms of things going on. He's it's replete throughout. The court didn't allow him to withdraw or allow him to waive counsel because of his concerns about mental health. How is this any different than Engelman?
In Engelman, the parties in the court were not aware of his severe mental health illness. In Engelman, the court found that he was suffering from a blunted state and was not fully able to understand what was happening during the hearing. In this case, there's no allegations that Celestine was not fully understanding what was happening or competent to stand the proceedings that day. So in Engelman, his mental health was not known, and so he was not being properly treated, and in fact, he was receiving a tranquilizer, which put him in a blunted state. Here, the parties knew of his mental health. He underwent the competency evaluation, which found him competent to stand trial or to proceed in this fashion. Further, regarding the factor that this court considers regarding withdrawal is, would withdrawal waste judicial resources? In this case, allowing withdrawal based only on second thoughts undermines plea finality and strains judicial resources without any justification grounded in law. Celestine failed to show a fair and just reason for wanting to withdraw his plea.
Well, in this case, the guilty plea or the Alford plea came the day trial was set, right?
Correct.
So state had been preparing for trial. They had a pretrial hearing. Presumably they'd subpoenaed witnesses. Is that prejudice?
That is some prejudice. I would like to note that it was known on the day of trial that is what was going to happen, is that he was going to enter into that plea, so it wasn't a surprise to the state or to the court that was going to happen. So the jury was not called that day. So that does lessen the prejudice, but there was still prejudice, as you just mentioned.
Wouldn't the fact that you're not going to have a trial be true for every time you're trying to withdraw a plea? I mean, is that really a good reason for judicial economy?
That is one factor, especially in this case where it was pointed out that the parties had been preparing for trial versus a case where a defendant pleads right away and there was no pretrial hearings and pretrial motions practices. Those are two different situations where the prejudice would be greater when the parties were preparing for trial. If the court does not have any further questions, I will move to my closing. The record demonstrates that Celestine's plea was knowingly, voluntary, and supported by a sufficient factual basis. Celestine failed to assert a fair and just reason for withdrawal of his plea. Permitting withdrawal under these circumstances would undermine the integrity of plea agreements, prejudice the state, and waste judicial resources. Therefore, the state asks this court to affirm Celestine's conviction. Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Mirabella, you may proceed with the rebuttal.
Thank you.
So I keep wondering in this case if this is significant or not. So the day of the plea, Alford plea, that the court says I want to order a pre-sentence investigation. Defense counsel kind of says, you know what, let's waive all that. He wants to waive it. I want to be sentenced today. Obviously, this case would look very different in terms of the motion to withdraw if sentencing had proceeded that day as the defendant wanted to that day. Is there any significance to that? I mean, I don't know that we have any cases that talk about it. I'm just asking your thoughts.
I think if that had happened, it probably would have significantly altered what happened here. Having a PSI, I understood why the circuit court wanted to have one for this case, to gather further information to try to make an appropriate decision, as opposed to taking a felony and rushing through it and making a decision just will go along with the recommendation and not further review it. I don't think there's any case law for my review that would give us further insight as to that, but that could have made things differently. I mean, that gives, you know, someone who decides to plea that day, that gives them more time to think about what they want to do. Now, in terms of time, and I don't think I need to spend much time on this, I think it's fairly agreed upon, it was agreed upon by the circuit court that the time here was very quick and that it favored him. I would submit that that's an important factor, but a smaller factor than some of the other more important ones. But I would also add to that factor that we had a case going on for 4 years, about 4.5, and it only took him a couple days to go back to what he had maintained his desires were. To the extent of the significance of opposing a dismissal, which certainly doesn't make any sense if you're sitting in the defendant's chair to do that, but in terms of how many years this was going on, where and then a very quick turnaround in terms of time. For prejudice here would be entirely speculative. I don't think that there's any even small indication that would exist here. It wouldn't end the analysis. By a lack of prejudice doesn't mean you automatically should get to withdraw. But that's really important for wondering how this might impact what the state has presented. But here we have the case being filed July of 2020, COVID and some other issues where we couldn't have trials. He eventually goes to trial 3 years later, July of 2023, exactly 3 years later. And there was no indication that the state had any difficulty producing the witnesses and the evidence. We had that trial. The conviction was not able to be reached by the jury. And then from there, the day that he ended up entering that plea was the day we were supposed to have the second trial and prepared to do so. Mr. Celestine made a choice that day to do something else. And I would note that a month before that, so October of 2024, we had a pretrial conference where everybody said we're ready to go. State said they were ready to go, even though it had been, you know, 4 years and change by that point. There were law enforcement witnesses that were readily available. There was no assertion that it would be difficult to find them or any loss of evidence or any
what,
of those.
What about the length of dependency? The length of the pendency of the case going on for 4 years as it did, while there was a federal case and other things that caused the delay. Could that in some way inform the court's discretion if the court otherwise felt like, look, I've got a knowing and voluntary plea. I feel good about that. I think the plea's provident and fine. The case has gone on for a long, long time, and it needs to end. And I'm not going to, in the exercise of my discretion, grant the motion to withdraw the plea. Does the pendency, the length of the case, the idea that a case needs to at some point have a beginning, a middle, and a terminal point where it ends in the trial court subject to appellate rights, would that figure into the court's discretion at all? Or could it?
I don't recall the specific case. It was persuasive authority off the top of my head from my brief, but there was a case that I cited on this issue that the relevant time period from that court's perspective is not from date of the underlying incident to when the plea is being requested to be withdrawn. The relevant time is when you do it, coming back to the timing of how quickly you want to take that back.
Yeah, I'm not sure. I mean, like you say, I don't think those are elements. I think those are factors. I think that a fair and just reason is the standard, and I think the court can look at a lot of different things, but do you disagree with that?
No, I agree that we can look at a lot of different components here. And again, because of the interest of my time here, wrapping up, the two most important components from my perspective for Mr. Celestine is the innocence that a jury already reviewed and the mental health component. That I think this is an even more problematic circumstance than what was found sufficient for State versus Engelman. And I will conclude as I see my time. May I briefly conclude?
Go ahead.
Thank you. For the primary reasons of the mental health component and the innocence component, as well as the other factors weighing for Mr. Celestine, he asked this court to reverse and remand to allow him to withdraw his plea. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel, for your arguments. We'll be in recess.